that has big time camp. What the movie will be the ultimate champ. You might be finger crazy, my finger diseased, but do you watch another chance to find the best of this?
We rate each movie in 5 categories, none of which are objective quality.
It's Stan, Gene, Jack and Nick who watch it till it's finished, because the love for this movie can be diminished. And make the film's plot has no rhyme or reason, but that's a part of charm.
Colin Brad is off the season.
It's low budget film that is most true. They find a flick that monster boogaloo.
Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo. Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Boogaloo! Welcome back, everybody. We got some Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo for you. This is Season 5 Astronauts, and we are so happy to be here talking about Battle Beyond the Stars. I am your host, 8th Dan Stanadu, and I am joined by Crack Jack Hall, Mac Jack Hall, Black Jack Hall.
What's up, cats?
And then I've also got with us James Cotta.
You know, I usually love to throw in a little riff right now, but this movie has George Peppard, and it wiped out every other like note I have. It's just Peppard. It's Peppard. Welcome to an episode where we get to talk about George Peppard.
There you go. Yeah, you can't beat him. So what are you gonna
you
do?
You think right? He had that belt in real life?
I imagine that was just how he dressed when he came in. I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, probably. And you've heard him talk. Here he is, Nick Boxer.
Greetings and salutations. I really enjoyed Space Rangers this week.
Well, there is a lot to be said about Battle Beyond the Stars and the amount of footage that it spawned, you know, for other movies. But tell us, Nick, tell us about Battle Beyond the Stars.
Well, you seen the Seven Samurai? You seen the Magnificent Seven? That in space. A giant space bully played by John Saxon raids a little farming, I think it's a farming mining community on a planet. They don't have much defenses. And says, I'm going to come back to destroy you in 7 cycles. There's no explanation what 7 cycles is. It seems like months. So the one guy who's ever been in a fight on this planet, an old crazy dude, tells them that they have to fight. So they send this young boy off to recruit bounty hunters to fight off the big space menace.
May I just say, they said it's 7 of your cycles. So they don't have to specify because the people knew on the planet what the cycles were.
Okay. Did not get that much.
It's true. So it really could be anything. And it hardly matters. I mean, in this kind of movie, the last thing that you're really trying, at least I hope that the last thing you're trying to figure out is that.
Young John Boy jumps in his spaceship with 2 huge breasts on the front of it to go get these bounty hunters, where he recruits several of them, including one original member of the Magnificent Seven, which was a great little Easter egg in there, and I enjoyed that greatly, who played exactly the same role he did in the Magnificent Seven. Other than that, we got some great space hijinks, and like that, it's fun. It is original, outside of the fact they stole everything from other sources. It's Roger Corman at his goofy best.
You know, when you say that it's the same character that Robert Vaughn is playing, literally some of the dialogue was lifted.
That's awesome.
Like, verbatim. Yeah, no, that is awesome. Actually, that's one of the best things about this movie.
You think they enticed Robert Vaughn by going, we don't even need you to memorize anything new.
Well, that and money. Most of the budget went towards Pardon. Like, there was a $2 million budget, and, like, most of that was Pardon and Vaughn. Paying those two actors.
Which is hilarious when you consider that a movie like this... it's an interesting element that you would put so many name actors in it, and you would wind up paying a couple of them so much, because you kind of wonder if that paid off or if it would have made about the same if you hadn't had even if you hadn't had both, but maybe if you just hadn't had one.
Well, I don't know. Was Sybil Danning a name at this point?
No, she wasn't. No.
That's gonna be my next question. Is like, is this like an intersection point where these people were like had been names or were about to be names, but actually like this was the day that you could get George Peppard for a song?
Like Sybil Danning actually in actuality, and this is the shock to anybody but us, was never a name.
It's a crying shame right there. her spaceship was amazing.
Her wardrobe was amazing.
That was one of my favorite parts of the whole movie. Was so she's the Valkyrie, her clothes match the name, but she flies her ship by laying, like, reclining.
Yeah. Splayed. I think splayed is the blade, only way.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can fly a ship like that, but
I
she does a fine
job. I spent most of the movie, once she changed in the second costume, trying to figure out if I could see her nipples or not.
The answer was almost.
Yeah, just not just quite.
Close enough you could still play it on television later.
Yeah, not unless you were on set, at which point on set, the only way they could get her clothes from falling off when she was acting was by using bandages. There's a ton of of Psycho Nuts trivia for this film. A ton.
Well, that's good.
Astronauts or whatever, or Psycho Facts or whatever the hell we were calling it this year. I don't even remember, but there's a ton of trivia.
I think it's changed about four times so far.
I do want to talk about the ship. So the main ship in it, variously described, and depending on the angle you look at it too. So Nick, describe the ship. The main characters, the hero ship.
It's a big orange region with two large breasts on the front of it.
Okay, so it looks like pendulous breasts to you, with kind of a Y shape at the top. Stan, well, do you have a different?
If you look at it from the right angle, I can see the breasts, but it kind of looks like
had nipples.
Yeah, I can see that. No question. To a certain degree, it kind of looks like a Jawa sand crawler floating through space.
Okay. Okay, Jack, different take.
Well, you know that thing that's on the front of the turkey. You know those two.
a waddle. Yep.
There you go.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'll go with a waddle.
I can see that. Yep.
Yeah, from the front, it looks like Hammerhead from
Hammerhead from, yes.
Yeah, from Star Wars. Yeah. where with like the two eye stalks that go out from the centerpiece. From the side, more like a scrotum to me. Yeah. You're right that there are what one could call nipples from the front, but you see that less from the side.
Yeah. It's a weird design for a ship. There's no question about it. I would love to know who was writing that one, drawing that one up. Like, was that James Cameron who was drawing that one up?
Originally they shot the footage for it, and then they decided it looked better upside down.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I believe there's another movie where they flip it again to use the ship.
Well, it is true, and it's not just that one. A lot of the designs on the ships in this one made you go, they did that because they thought it would look interesting, not because it's actual practical design for a ship.
I think more movies should do that. I enjoyed most of the ships in this. In fact, the special effects on this are mind-blowing. I mean, this could have been a Star Wars. I don't know why it's not. There's... I think there's too many WTFs in this movie to be a Star Wars, but it could have been. I mean, we got excellent acting by some members of the crew. We've got special effects. John Sayles wrote this thing. It could have been huge. It wasn't.
Well, I mean,
and it's good Boogaloo fun, but.
It struggles. Here's the thing. I mean, it struggles to me in its low budgetiness, but otherwise, I mean, for the most part, yeah, the acting's good. The story's good. There's not, it doesn't necessarily tick off the boxes for me to be Boogaloo. Like, it's got Boogaloo elements, but it doesn't quite fit the Boogaloo bill. I find at the end.
Oh yeah, you could watch this in a public place without any embarrassment whatsoever.
Yes.
Well, exactly. I mean, I really enjoyed this film, but this is the second film of the season where and I didn't like it as much as Planet of the Vampires, but yeah, I mean, I consider it more a good film than a Boogaloo film.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you talk about the WTFs, I thought it was really light on WTFs. There was a few, but you know, it's not like loaded with them or anything. But man, there are some great special effects, and it's just fun.
And there's some great moments, there's just some really funny scenes that I found really kind of interesting. I mean, there's no question that George Peppard, his cowboy character, brings a lot to it. I mean, you gotta love the scotch and soda and ice cube belt. That's just that. Good fun. But even like there's the moment when Gelt, Robert Vaughn's character dies, and Richard Thomas, you know, winds up telling him, you know, bury him with food. I promised him a meal and a place to stay, and you know, and that was a good moment. Like those are the kind of moments that you normally don't see in your standard Boogaloo movie, right?
So I'm disappointed in you.
Did you guys
you called him Richard Thomas, man. He's John Boy.
Oh, sorry about that. Next time I'll call him John Boy Shad. Shad John Boy.
I never saw a single episode of that show.
You should probably consider yourself lucky then.
Yeah, I feel fine about that. Yeah. I see that you're not calling me out on it. I missed a cultural touchstone.
Hey,
I'm just waiting for Walton's The Next Generation.
you still know, despite having never seen the Waltons, you still know what we're talking about when we say John Boy.
So yeah, it must have been on. I think it was on right before like the A-Team or something, because I know the ending of the show without ever having watched an episode.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably one of like I watched the next thing that was on after it.
Yeah. And you heard Goodnight, John Boy. And
yeah.
That's the end.
That's literally all I know. I know what the house looked like and Goodnight, John Boy, but and then the Knight Rider theme song or whatever it was about.
Well, I mean, so, the A-Team would be perfect.
So, if you didn't know going in, how long before you realized it was Seven Samurai?
It's pretty cool. It's got to be. It's so like 5 minutes. I mean, because really everything happens really quickly overall. To get you into the part, like, I mean, when Sador comes down, that's really fast. You see it, and then 2 minutes later, you've got the old guy telling him that Jeff Corey Zed telling you that you've got to go find mercenaries. You got to fight, even though that's not part of their religion.
Basically, as soon as this Star Road ripoff stuff stops.
Yes, and it's true. There was a lot of those shots.
They copied the opening of Star Wars, like, shot by shot for the first, like, minute and a half.
But see, here's an interesting thing. My son, Van, came in really, you know, for about 10 minutes and watched some of the space battle at the end. I didn't give him any information about the movie, but he came and sat and watched some of it, and he's like, oh, this looks a lot like Star Wars. <It's> like, who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Okay. The aliens look like Star Trek, and the rest of the movie looks like Star Wars.
And Jeff Corey. Thanks for name dropping Jeff Corey.
I love Jeff Corey. Like,
Jeff Corey is just amazing. He was in like 200 movies or something. This is like 1980, and he's the wizened old man at the, like, already in this.
Oh yeah, I mean, I know that we're gonna see a lot of Boogaloo movies with Jeff Corey in it, and I mean, it makes me happy because he's another one of those guys that, you know, good character guys that show up. You know they're gonna do a good job of being in the movie, and it's just, you know, that part's locked down.
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed that wasn't a bigger role, actually.
Yeah, I can see that.
Was he blind in this movie?
Yes.
Okay.
He definitely
he's played a lot of blind characters. That's all I'm saying.
Well, yeah, because there's that.
I forgot whether or not it was.
There's that moment right off the top when Sador's coming down. Like, his ship is coming down, and everybody else is like, oh my god! And, you know, Jeff Corey's character is just, like, staring off someplace else. And I'm like, he's either blind, or this is really fucking Boogaloo right now. But yeah, blind. I can't class him staring into, staring off someplace else as Boogaloo.
I gotta say, when we first meet George Peppard, who is, like a Southern gent, and some sort of just wandering the galaxy. He's actually an Earthman, but he's being attacked by these ships, and they're firing on him, and the lasers are kind of bouncing off his force field. That's one of the coolest force field effects I've ever seen.
Oh, bar none.
Like it really, like, because it's not absorbing the blasts like they do in things now, because you can get it, like, you can make this, like, shoosh, like,
yeah,
light effect. Like, it's actually just ricocheting off the force field like, right, you would want it to do.
That was a force field? I thought those were just really bad lasers.
No, it was totally a force field, because they say that you know, oh, after they burn through the force field, then they can actually attack the ship.
I'm just glad those ships didn't have a heat ray.
Mm-hmm.
There was a moment like there's several moments like that where it's just little touches, like when they go to see Dr. Hephaestus and the androids that they have, every time one of them moves, there's that little, like, you know, metallic turning, you know, machine turning sound. Doesn't matter what, you know, what they're doing, every time it happens, and it's really nicely laid in. And I thought, wow, so many Boogaloo movies would not think of putting that touch in to a movie.
At the same time, I kind of wondered why they were all balding.
maybe because, like, the guy who designed them just, you know, God made him in his image kind of thing.
No, I mean, considering the time period this was filming, breakdancing was starting to be a thing. You'd think they'd just put out a casting call for dancers.
I think breakdancing was about 5 years, 4 years after this, still. Wasn't it? Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. It feels like that's right. Because yes, they all have to kind of do that robot move, which is the ones that they do have, quite impressive at it.
The one android who sacrificed himself to escape the room, I guess, or prison, I thought that one arm movement waving them through the door after he was dead was a little bit much. But other than that, I thought they were all excellent.
I did like that that rig, though, like when that captor grid, I think they call it, the thing that's holding him in the room. Yeah, the, like, 6-point laser firing at the center point. Like, I thought that was really cool, like a neat idea. I hadn't seen Airwolves.
They could have cheaped out and did a force field, but no, the full on lasers.
Yep.
ready to take you out. That's unique.
Mm.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, so many movies would have definitely gone less You know, and could have gone less quite easily. Like, oh no, I walked into a force field. Poof. You know, how terrible. I will never escape.
Or just like a little electrical thing that's like motion detector or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, it's like you say, though. I mean, this movie is, it's kind of the best of Roger Corman. And that it's, I mean, number one, at $2 million, it was like the most expensive film he had made up to that point. You know? But also, I mean, it is loaded with good people who made it, from the script writer to the director to the effects department, like, and even in the cast, right? Like, it's loaded with those people. They're just kind of those young up and coming people that go on to do something and have a successful career. And his eye for talent, right, was always like, I don't know that this is like Galaxy of Terror came out, I think, about the same time, and it probably would have been more Boogaloo, mm-hmm. right, from Corman, right? Like, you know, yeah. but there'll be a point where we'll probably have an all Corman season, I hope, or maybe 50, because I think he's done 500 movies. But
in a year, exactly.
Like, well, he literally, I think his highest was something like 26 movies one year he produced in the 90s, if I remember correctly. Like one every 2 weeks, just ridiculous. But yeah, like this is kind of the best of the Corman. So, I mean, we have this really good movie, made a little bit of money. It made $11 million on its thing and got like a $750,000 from HBO and, you know, $2 million for European rights. Like it was a profitable film. And has become a cult favorite, but it's not, I don't think it's going to score quite where it would if we had different, if we were, maybe this is one of those ones again, that we're not basing on objective quality, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, where's the tipping point, right? Because it's very funny because we've had two movies in this with some really strong actors, but you look at Star Crash, and that has Christopher Plummer, and he's one of the best actors ever. Mm-hmm. But there's that tipping point where Christopher Plummer in that is totally Boogaloo, because maybe because he's brought down by everything else. Whereas in this case, there's so many people that it pulls the film that could have been super Boogaloo out to being really good, because there's all this quality people in it.
Yeah, if you don't have John Saxton there, that role would come off as ridiculous. As it is right now, it just comes off as sort of silly.
Yeah, I mean, John Saxton's not at the level of like a Robert Vaughn by any stretch of the imagination. But
I love John Saxton.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, he's John Saxton goes Boogaloo at times in his pictures. So.
Since John Saxon's been brought up. Now, I obviously missed the thing about the seven cycles. Is his replacing of the arm and seeming leprosy ever like broached before they?
Oh yeah, totally.
No, try to attach somebody's arm.
I missed it.
Then, it was.
It's part of the end, right? He wants to live forever, and so he replaces bits as he needs to live forever.
Yeah, and it's referenced, I think he's like 200 years old or something like that. Like, he has been living a long time doing that, replacing parts. Yeah. No, and that's a scene that, like, I watched it going, oh, this is going to be Boogaloo. Then I watched it and went, boy, should it be way more Boogaloo.
Yeah. In fact, well, to me, it's one of my favorite moments at the very end, you know, as he dies. Like, I love that moment.
Well, I think the weirdest part of this is that so John Saxon and his goons come to this peaceful world, and he's like, you know, you're gonna be our slaves, or we're gonna blow the whole place up. And then he's like, we're gonna come back in seven cycles, which, you know, assumes 7 days. But then there's like, we're gonna go run some errands. We got some other people we gotta threaten. Guys stay
big,
here.
It's a big
out.
Galaxy.
We'll be back. We'll
Jim, it's a big freaking galaxy.
Well, you can't stay alive by just going and threatening one at a time. Like you gotta make a schedule, stick to your schedule, and like, okay, so that's this system. I'm gonna clear out this system, but then I gotta go to the next system and I gotta work that one for a little while. Because otherwise, what's the point?
Is what you're
saying. Yeah.
I'm also sort of curious why the planet they end up obliterating, they send an emissary to that they're able to send back in a little baggie. Yet our main planet just gets a video transmission going, we're coming back from you, for you.
I like that John Saxon's has like the disco lightning bolt across his eye.
Yes.
That's a good look. I dig that.
That was so pre-Harry Potter. Yeah.
That's right. Harry Potter stole from this. That's yeah. Like, there is no other logical explanation.
That's right.
You can't just come up with an idea like that. You know, like that's...
No. Lightning bolts above the eye. That's specific, man.
Now, the bad guy troopers, do you think they were like surgically built? They call them mutants, but they have weird scars. Well, they all have the same weird scar plastered somewhere on their face.
Perhaps that was just more of a...
No, I just couldn't figure out like what they were. Was it a race, or have they been mutated somehow? Are they surgically built? Are they old like John Saxon, only they have lesser parts? I don't know.
Excellent questions, all. The answers are not provided in the material.
I also wonder what the, you know, what the mess hall looked like in the sleeping quarters on that ship. But
so before we get to scoring, I have kind of I think it's a larger question about science fiction. But so at one point, our heroine, our female lead, gets kidnapped, and there's like a lizard guy who makes some comments about how hot she is. In science fiction, why is it that human women are like the ideal feminine form, no matter what species has grabbed them?
Well, it's you.
I thought he was a miner for protein, not.
No, he was gonna eat her. He was gonna sell her, so that he could buy protein. Mm-hmm. But I find it very interesting because it's either one side or the other side. It's either, oh, you humans are so hideous, which is the ha-ha funny. Or it's this side where it's just like, ah, yes, human females, I can get a good price for you.
But like, I mean, Jabba the Hutt being like the quintessential, like he has attractive humanoid women. Like, mm-hmm. what's he going to do with them? Do you ever look at it's like a human guy looking at a slug going, look at that one. Yeah. So I want to keep that one around the house.
You ever seen a female hut? It's not a tough decision to make.
And I mean, your answer is obviously marketing, but
yeah. after this Leia slave girl costume, everything else you completely understand.
Again, this came first, so
yeah, that's for true.
Sure, ripping off from this.
Was anyone else sortly kind of appalled by the weird rape thing going on?
Yeah, I was
going
to bring that up.
It was completely out of place with the movie.
Yeah, here you have really quite a friendly family type movie, mm-hmm. and then that, like, mutants raping off screen, sure, but it's what's happening. It's really like kind of like,
yeah, they kidnap a woman from I'm assuming that it's just lifted directly from Magnificent Seven or something, like, yeah, and in that context of that movie, it would make more sense, but it just seems to come out of nowhere in this.
Not to mention, once they blow up that ship with her on board, we then get George Peppard going, beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, well, but he doesn't, I mean, George Peppard doesn't know the Julia Duffy's on that ship.
Yeah, but we do.
Yeah, no, that was a really weird choice.
Yeah, it's not just any woman either. It's like the, you know, the cute maid from Newhart is who it is.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, so it's like extra. Like, I mean, it's not like it's good. It was going to be okay either way, but I mean, it's a little extra.
If you're a child of the 80s, that's hard. That's hard.
That's a heartbreaker right there.
Yeah, that's true.
We all love Julia Duffy. Are we ready to go into scoring here?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. In our search for the ultimate B-movie, we rate every film in five categories, none of which is objective quality. The first category we call schlock appeal, and we start with Stan.
Well, as I said earlier, I think it really comes down for me to there's a few parts where I feel like its low budgetness is very obvious. But for the most part, they work really well against that. So it's not as schlocky as I was expecting when I first started watching. So I'm only going to be able to give it a 4.
I can go as high as a 7 just on the basis of it copied Star Wars, the opening shot. That takes balls.
Man, and so many do that.
No, I mean this came out probably less than a year after Star Wars.
Well, Star Wars was 77. This was not 1980. So
Okay. Yeah. Okay. My bad. But still, I mean, close enough. People knew the shot. They knew what was going on.
And Star Wars wasn't in the theaters.
I'm
sorry. Go ahead, please.
They made no attempt to differentiate themselves from that. They copied an existing movie. They have Sybil Danning in it in skimpy costumes. I think the shock appeal is higher than a 4-7. It's not way up there, but it's on the high end of schlock, I think.
Well, it's a really enjoyable movie. And so it's like, but it's not enjoyable because of the schlock, because of the you know, it's like you almost forget this is a low budget movie in some ways, which is a weird thing about it. And you know, it's a good and it's a positive and a negative. So I'm going to go with a 6.
I'm going to be on the high end here. I think the stuff like the Valkyrie's outfit. I think some of the actors that we had that you know we will see again. Jeff Corey's going to show up again for sure. John Saxon's going to show up again. I'm trying to think if he has shown up already because in the action season,
in
the spot we would have seen him if I.
Sybil Danning, she'll be there.
Sybil Danning will turn up.
Robert Vaughn's going to show up too.
Yes.
God, I know a movie where he's a blind guy fighting crows.
Oh, nice.
Zombie crows.
What?
I'm in.
How
I'm
did
in.
You not pick this in the horror? It had to be.
And we've got aliens that look like aliens. We've got like mutants and such. So I'm giving this an 8. Our next category we call more heart than budget.
Well, I mean, $2 million would normally for us seem like a really big budget, but knowing that budget went towards George Pappard and Robert Vaughn, then I can honestly say that they did a shit ton with what money they had left, because the special effects in this and all that stuff are extremely good. So I'm going to go with a 10.
10. Every set is on that screen and everyone's given their all. They think they're in Star Wars. This is going to make their careers. The old guys think it's a comeback. The young guys think it's their big break.
And a lot of people that did make their careers. So.
Yeah, it was the high point. It was the peak.
Well, no, but it's so true. Like, okay, obviously you have James Cameron, but he also met Gail Ann Hurd on the set, who produced Terminators and Aliens and The Abyss with him and was his wife for a while. Who was it? Ken Howard, I think is the name, or of the composer who ended up composing.
James Newton. That's wrong. who is the composer?
Yeah, the composer. I mean, he ends up composing the Academy Award, winning the Academy Award for Best
Original James Horner. Score. James Horner.
James Horner. That's it. Thank you, James Horner for Titanic.
And this score is awesome.
Bill, yeah, exactly. Bill Paxton is works on the set as a carpenter. That's what gets him cast. It becomes a friendship with Gail Ann Hurd. It's loaded with these type of things. I mean, we talk about Julie Duffy, who we know, and all these people. Comedian Kathy Griffin has a small bit as an extra when they're looking at a spaceship landing. In this movie, like you probably didn't notice it because that was the part of the movie that wasn't nearly as talented or funny as I thought it was. But, but yeah, anything less than a 10 would be a crying shame for this movie.
I saw Randall Frakes, who wrote like The Terminator and stuff like that. He was one of the people involved in the movie as well. So, I mean, you know, that whole like James Cameron group was here and really got to start here.
Yeah, they talk about in football, they talk about the Andy Reid coaching tree, how this coach and all his assistants go on to become successful coaches everywhere else. This is like the James, or I guess this is the Roger Corman tree.
Yeah.
Right? Like a lot of it stems from this, actually.
All right, well, far be it for me to go against the grain. Let's make this a clean sweep, tens across the board. This is just they brought it for what should be a cynical money grab kind of thing. Like they didn't leave it on the field for sure. That's they did what they turned out something really interesting for what they had. Our next category called what the fuck moments.
Well, I really agree with Jack here in that I don't find that there's a lot of what the fucks. I think for me, the biggest that there's two awesome moments for me. So for one, I'm going to point to Sybil Danning's Valkyrie outfit. That thing is one of the worst design elements of there.
Which one are you talking about?
I'm talking about
that
her.
That is made of styrofoam, or the second one?
I'm talking about her headdress.
I love the second one.
Yes. Not her outfit is fantastic, but her headdress looks like it was put together with some really chunky styrofoam. Like it's not a sleek and shiny Valkyrie headdress like you would expect. It's really clunky and chunky and fakey looking. And then
I will show her the ropes anytime she wants.
And then the other moment is there's those two characters that give off heat. The Kelvin characters, and there's this absolutely amazing moment where
the campfire scene.
Yes, where they are sitting in the middle, people are warming their hands to them, and freaking George Peppard's cowboy character is doing hot dogs, roasting hot dogs against them. Now that part right there, it's. Any other movie that gets a 10 just for having that scene, but the fact that they did it in seriousness and it actually came off well, I'm only going to go with a 5.
I don't know how well it came off, because personally, it's on my WTF scale, but I never realized he was roasting over the people until this very viewing. I've seen this movie more than a couple times, and each time somehow I just missed the fact there wasn't a campfire and he's roasting them over the people.
I do love that. It's great.
Yeah, no, and particularly crazy. How about the fact that they reduced the budget by not understanding trench warfare?
That's a good point.
No, they make all these trenches for the bad guys and connect them to the good guys' trenches. There is no battle that takes place that's outside of the trenches. They never look up. The bad guys get a tank to roll through the trenches without any resistance whatsoever. John Saxon's replacing body parts with little to no explanation. I don't understand half the characters. They hire seven mercenaries and not offer one of them payment whatsoever.
Well, they all died.
Oh, true. But I mean, still, they're hiring people. And, you know, I can buy Robert Vaughn, but, you know, you'd think that they give him a little bag of gold. Or the Magnificent Seven, there was a bag of gold.
Well, they understood what, you know, I mean, everybody had their various reasons. I mean, Kamen came because he wanted Sador's head. You know, I mean, a lot of these guys, they came for different reasons than Sador could have been ridden
out of this movie really quickly. He was kind of useless for the entire thing.
Other than being the main villain?
Oh, not the reptile dude.
Oh, Kamen.
Kamen. He was useless. I mean, his little buddies, the Eat dudes,
yes,
were useful,
yes.
But...
No, and
only because
and,
they took out the tank, but
yeah, and
I freaking love
the
that
Barbarian.
They take out. I love that they take out the tank, because the idea is that like they make music and then they give off heat while they're making music. So they essentially take out the tank by yelling at it. I really love that. What was your number there, Nick? I don't think I actually heard a number.
Oh, no, I never gave a number.
that'd be why I didn't hear it.
Yeah. I'm going with a 5. I mean, they're definitely WTFs, but not huge on the WTF.
Hey, you know the alien character Nestor, the one mind, the guy who did all the speaking for them, the lead one? He was the psychiatrist in the Terminator and the Terminator 2. Just another one. Just another... it's not a lot. I mean, there's a few, like, I mean, the fact that just kind of like that we've brought them up, like the rape scene, the breast ship. There's the fact that when he shows up on that planet to get, the farm boy shows up on the planet to get these weapons or whatever. Instead, he's told that he should stay on the planet and just be with the daughter of the guy who runs the planet and just repopulate it, cause he wants children. He wants grandchildren on it. And that would of course cost his entire planet to die, but he doesn't even consider it. And she's really hot. Mm-hmm. So that's a WTF for me. I would have at least taken 5-10 seconds to think it over in my mind.
You think they went back?
they could always go back. Like that's
they could always that's, go back. Yeah. I don't know. It's pretty light on the WTFs though, as like I say, because it's well made. So I'm only going to go with a 3.
Yeah, like I think the rape scene really stands out as because it's so tonally different than the rest of it. I think I called it the SS cock and balls. You can call it you can say the breast ship if you want. The Valkyrie's outfits are amazing though. Like she's got that, like it's like a styrofoam. It looks like Valkyrie from the comic books with like the, so it looks like cosplay Valkyrie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is true that every single time that Sybil Danning turned quickly, I thought this movie was going to go from a PG to an R.
well, her second outfit, which is, a very new wave. Like she's a, kind of ahead of the game, because it's like it's leather but with like slash cuts out of it, so she manages to have side boob from one breast and under boob from the other. Like it's a nice outfit. One of the oddest things is that this is like the far, far distant future and international space or like interplanetary space, and George Pappard's ship has a Confederate flag on it.
Yeah, yes. That's like just the whole. They never explained the character at all. It's not where he got from or how it was there, and then the fact that the Confederate flag is there was.
Well, they did say he watched movies.
Yeah, he loves movies.
Yeah, he watched his old Western movies.
I just assumed that. Mm-hmm. I always pictured him as like really, he's born on a moon or something, yeah. And.
How
always
did somebody
wanted
from Earth get out
her.
There? They never explained this to me. Like, what point in space in our history and whatever? Like, we still got hot dogs and the Confederate flag, but we're out in space. Like
the future, goddammit.
So, like, 2030, maybe.
Well, I mean, 1965, depending on what movie you watch, right?
All right. I'm going to call that a 4. Our next category called Memorable Moments.
Well, there's a couple moments that stick out to me. There, the moment where I keep wanting to call him Hannibal because that's always what he is to me. But where George Pappard, the Scotch soda and stuff like that belt, and I feel like a similar kind of belt has been used multiple times. So I'm gonna include that. But for me, just the John Saxon right at the end, just as the ship is destroyed, like his incredulity about being destroyed, like I just wanted to live forever. Like it's just such
is
a
that's so wrong.
Yeah, but it's just I wanted to live forever. Why can't you people understand that? But I just love that moment. Like there's actually quite a bit of the movie that I think will stick with me, and moments like that I feel like are more memorable than anything. So I'm going to go with a 7.
By the way, I checked Amazon. They're not selling that belt yet.
That's too bad. Because Although I can't imagine how it carried as much as he drank.
No, I mean, there are a lot of great moments in this movie, but I think they've been, either they were ripped off from other movies or they've reused the footage elsewhere, that it might be hard to identify the great moments to this movie after you've watched it. Certainly there are entertaining stuff. I really enjoyed the "we have no I have no tolerance for pain" joke during the arm cutting scene, and he just dies and they all agree. But yeah, I can't go higher than a 4 on that for memorable moments. Just a little too similar to other stuff.
Well, it's true that this movie was, like, the scenes were recycled a lot. And a lot of other Corman movies, and in fact, this even shows up in, like, other movies. Like, it showed up in a video game that Sega put out in the early 80s, footage from this. It shows up in Bachelor Party with Tom Hanks. When they're at a movie theater watching a 3D movie, it's this scenes from this. Like, so you have seen this stuff. So I can understand how that could kind of mess you up on this. But, I mean, I really remember the special effects. There's one shot in particular where it was like a close-up of the speech engines from behind, and they're just flaring, and they just look so powerful, and like they're just screen bright red. And I'm just like, it's just such a – like, it just looks so damn good. But at the end of the day, the one that I think is the most memorable, we already talked about the hot dog, but the actual quote, okay, is the greatest thing ever. Nestor One, like we say, the kind of the one mind character who's all minds in this species are together, is eating a hot dog for the first time. He's told it's a hot dog, you know, and Cowboy George Pappard offers it to him, and he goes, "There's no dog in this," and Cowboy. A cowboy goes, uh-huh. And then he goes, "Hydrolyzed vegetable protein, soybean meal, niacin, dextrose, and sodium nitrate flavoring." And cowboy goes, "Yep, that's what we call meat back home." That, to me, is one of the greatest lines in movie history. I got an 8 on this.
All right. Unforeseen. I don't remember any of this movie having watched it a week ago. Give it a 3. it did have some fun stuff to it though. For sure. All right, our final category we call crazy concept.
All right. Well, it's Star Wars meets the Magnificent Seven. At the time, that wasn't a very crazy concept. I'm only, like, there's a few elements to the aliens and stuff like that, some funny things that they had to do because they were in space, but I'm only going with the 3.
Yeah, there's a reason this is Roger Corman's highest budgeted film. It was the one where he go, "We can't lose money on this one."
Yeah.
3.
You guys are so hard on this. I mean, okay, Magnificent Seven in space is not the craziest concept, but then you throw in the different crazy alien ideas, and more so, John Saxon's character living forever by taking different body parts and grafting them to himself. That's pretty damned insane. So I got a 5.
And you know what? Maybe if it were better explained, I got it, but we know that Nick didn't get it. So that I think needed to be better explained.
But Nick doesn't get much.
But shouldn't that have driven up the number though? Like that's not an argument against it.
But does that make it a crazy concept, or is that just an element that didn't quite come off? Right? I don't necessarily view it as a crazy concept.
I consider it a crazy concept. 5.
All right, I don't. 3.
Fair enough.
All right. Okay, so every season we have 6 secret modifiers. Mathematically, the most you can get is 5, and this movie has 5. It does run over the 95-minute cutoff, so it gets a minus one for that. We do have a modifier we haven't seen yet, but this one has the rubber-suited aliens. We've got the mutants that have the kind of they're almost pullover masks a couple of times, yep. And then we have the lizard guy. We have the Star Warts, the blatant ripoff of Star Wars minus one. We also get a plus one for having an original score, and we get a plus one for what we call space talk, because they mention cycles, they mention the capture grid, plastoid. There's a bunch of stuff like that thrown.
Oh yeah,
in.
So, and the giant weapon that they have, that Sador has, the stellar converter. I mean, that's almost as good as Planet of the Vampires, right? I mean, because what the hell does a stellar converter do?
Not forget the kooky space religion.
Yeah, that's right.
Stellar converter. That's Force Awakens stole stellar converter from this. So you know, if we had a Star Wars stole from this plus, this would definitely have picked up.
I mean, that's the thing. Is this a ripoff of Star Wars, or is it just an homage? I mean, Star Wars stole from Kurosawa, and this planet that it's called the Akira. You know, there's the beings, because and that's in reference and homage to Akira Kurosawa, and you know. So hey, maybe I'm making an argument that's not going to win, aren't I?
Well,
acknowledging where you stole stuff from is not exactly it.
Yeah, I don't even know what you're arguing, to be honest with you.
That's a good point, that this steals from Star Wars, which stole from Kurosawa, and steals from Magnificent Seven, which stole from Kurosawa. That'll be, I mean, really, Kurosawa should have gotten at least a thank you out of this.
Yeah, he really should have.
Wait, let's just say that everybody stole from Akira Kurosawa.
Wow, yeah.
Right, so with all the modifiers, that gives us a final total of 58 out of 100. All putting right. it right in this fifth. I don't know how many movies we've got within four or five. 50
now. who scored it the highest then?
Let's see. That gives Jack the top score for
as usual.
And then Nick, Stan, even, and I was only 1 point back from them. So we were a pretty tight grouping.
Pretty tight, yeah, for sure. Understandable, really. I mean, it's just a really good movie that you know, you can argue some boogaloo, you can argue not some boogaloo, but overall, it's a really enjoyable, engaging watch.
I would watch it before any of the Star Wars prequels.
it's you know, this is, I would watch this over many, many, many of the movies that we've talked about so far. But
yeah, this is one I will actually watch again just for enjoyment. Yep. You know, if you got Amazon Prime, rip it. You know, it's got great sound design too.
Yeah, for sure.
We never even talked about it, so you know, yeah.
And the score is killer. I love James Horner's score of this. So, all right, tell the folks there, Jim, where they can find us on the internet.
All right, we are on Instagram at Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo, and use that hashtag when talking about B-movies that you love. Also for Facebook and Twitter, our podcast sponsors, We Talk Podcasts, have presence on those platforms. And visit wetalkpodcast.com for the Octagon, our running total of our running chart of our search for the ultimate B-movie.
Yeah, and it's not only a running chart, we should mention, you know, people, if they click on the movie that they see the score on, it'll take them to the episode.
Yes, it's
really handy.
Yeah, so you can use it as a checklist as you're watching all of the movies that we have talked about. You know, watch the film, listen to what we say.
A couple don't.
Maybe
the ones right at the bottom.
Maybe listen to us. Yeah, I mean, like the AFI Top 100, and I think that I can make an equivalency.
Not watch the Chocolate Bunny movie.
Yeah, start from the top and work your way down.
I love that he calls it the Chocolate Bunny movie.
Just
not even.
That's okay. We all want to forget that we watched it.
All right. Close up the mailbag.
Okay. All right. Well, next episode, we carry on the battle section of Astronauts with Battle in Outer Space. So we've got lots of fighting going on, which is great. Gotta love the fighting on some Boogaloo fighting. All right. So I am your host, 8th Dan Stanadu. Join us next episode for Battle in Outer Space as we carry on with Season 5 of the Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo Astronauts. So, for Jim and for Jack and for Nick, thank you for listening to the Kung Fu Electric Boogaloo!
Ruthless invaders, a defenseless planet, battle beyond the stars. A lone youth escapes on a last-ditch mission that begins at the edge of the universe. The story of a boy who finds more than he expected.
Make them burn.
And all he can handle.
Does your species have kissing?
Oh, yes. We have that.
Try one. That's a hot dog. It comes from Earth. Do you like it?
There's no dog in this.
Mm-mm. Soybean meal, niacin, dextrose, and sodium nitrate flavoring. That's what we call meat back home.
Battle beyond the stars. Starring Richard Thomas, George Pappard, Robert Vaughn, John Saxon, a battle beyond time, beyond space.
Nice dead fire!
That ends in a desperate gamble.
They'll be able to board us.
It won't make any difference.
Get that hatch open! No!
Battle beyond the stars.